Let me begin, David, with a question about the image of God. Do you want to expand on that? Because that seems to be a kind of crucial concept in terms of us talking about what it is to be human and how that relates to pre-hominid.
Well, that's an intriguing and very and difficult question, because I read several theologians, including a whole book by G.C. Burkhauer on the image of God, and like my talk tonight, by the time I got to the end, I really wasn't sure what he had said at all. You know, so. But like any other Irishman, even though I don't know the answer, I'll keep talking for a minute or two. So. Well, first thing that I think is quite interesting about this, from the point of view of the history of an idea, before we would even get to sort of nailing our colours to what is the image of God, very difficult question, and more particularly, how does it relate at all to the Adam story? Very, very important questions. The first thing I would say about this is that I have a suspicion that if you were to track a history of what the image of God was thought to be, in other words, a history of what people have believed the image of God to be, I think that what you would find would be a story that would very much reflect the obsessions of the era in which the particular person was writing. You know, so, I mean, I just speculate. I suspect that in the period of the Enlightenment, something like human reason would be elevated as really, you know, as a key point of what the image of God might be. Maybe in the early part of, maybe in our own era, something like the need to be in community because that because God is a Trinity and lives in community, that might be a sort of element and so on. And I just suspect it would be an interesting project to try to show that the history of this idea has mirrored the obsessions of one generation to the next. But I do think it's the case that, right back to St. Augustine, there is a concern not to find whatever the Imago Dei refers to not find it in physical attributes of one sort or another, color of skin or anything of that sort. Nor is it, I think, would it have anything to do with upright posture, a particular size of brain, or any of those sorts of things. So a proposal that did come on the scene, which is a term I think that comes from John Stott, and I think, Neville, we were talking about this, is the concept of thinking of the human in terms of the image of God is to think of the human not in terms of science as Homo sapiens and what distinguishes Homo sapiens from predecessors, but rather more this sort of sense of a being with spiritual capabilities, Homo divinus, as it has sometimes been called, that we image God in the capacity for worship and so on. But of course there are difficulties, I think, also going down that route of capability, because a young child might not have the capability to worship, or a person perhaps who suffers from Alzheimer's disease or something may not have that capability. So I think that there are difficulties on every front here, and I think that we just need a lot more thought about it. Whatever this is, it distinguishes the human as we think of it from the rest of the creation. How it relates to the Genesis narrative and the narrative of Adam is, I think, simply built into the text that Adam was created or fashioned in the likeness of God. And it's from that, I think, that then we elaborate, and you need to ask Desi about Genesis 1, what meaning might be there. I think that's why it is typically attached to descent from Adam, since Adam seems to have been the creature who is described as fashioned after God's likeness. What it can't be, therefore, is, unless we assume that God is DNA, it can't be a likeness that is in our DNA in any physical or genetic sense. And that's about all that I'd care to say at the moment about the image of God.
Thank you very much. There's a number of questions here. We're sorry you left out the bit about Eve.
Ah, yes.
My daughter's favourite joke, David, is God made man, and then he said to himself, I think I can do better than that.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you. That's the answer to the question. So the intriguing question about Eve is that, curiously, as I've read around a number of theologians in the 19th century who were grappling with the challenges of Darwin's theory of evolution. Several of them felt that there was only really one verse in Scripture that prevented, these were Orthodox theologians, only one verse in Scripture that might prevent a serious Christian from adopting an evolutionary viewpoint. And that is the story of the creation of Eve. The creation of Eve from out of Adam's rib. And that literal, that story taken literally was regarded by a number of key theologians, B.B. Warfield, for example, among them, to be the one text that stood in the way of adopting an evolutionary viewpoint. Now, I just want to say two things about this that I think were rather interesting. First of all, this particular verse in Genesis was a subject of debate, and I'm just going to check my notes to get the dates exactly right. It's a subject of debate in the House of Lords in the early part of in the middle part of the 19th century. The question was, you know, is this a fable? Or is it a metaphor? Or is it a literal truth? Now, why was the whole question of how you interpret this verse about the creation of Eve showing up in the House of Lords? Well, it was to do with a bill that had been introduced in Parliament in 1842 about this, and it was entitled the Deceased Wife's Sister Bill. It was a bill to overthrow the prohibition of a person marrying a deceased wife's sister. This verse was actually critically important because if Eve was made out of Adam, there were some curious arguments to say that, of course, marrying a sister-in-law would actually be a form of incest. Now, in fact, the person who most was concerned about rethinking these verses of all people was Thomas Henry Huxley. Huxley constantly returned to the problems of this verse and how absurd it was and how impossible it was to be a Darwinian and accept an evolutionist and accept this verse. For this reason, of course, that his own daughter, Ethel, had to travel to Norway in order to legitimately marry her deceased sister's husband, who was the distinguished artist John Collier. So a verse about the, first of all, about the creation of Eve was critically important for thinking about marital relations and whether or not marriage, going back to Leviticus, I think, chapter 18, whether this was one of the bars on marriage, seemed to be dependent on what the House of Lords was going to think about that Genesis text. The other thing, of course, is that the rejection of this verse was seen to have other kinds of implications, particularly in American Presbyterianism. And the reason for this, of course, was that the text of this verse was used by many to demonstrate, not like your heretical daughter, not the superiority of Eve, but the subservience of Eve to Adam from whom she was created. The reason, of course, that Americans were concerned about losing the literal interpretation of that verse and that significance was because there are debates going on about women preachers and whether or not they should legitimately be ordained and so on because they had a subservient position and this verse about creation was pulled into that political context. All I was trying to say from those verses was simply this: on any of these verses, you would be amazed at the political and cultural uses that are appealed to and are used in order to say what the right interpretation for that time any particular verse has. So that was my little aside on Eve, and the real reason I put it in was because I felt that I needed some gender equality with all those males on the screen tonight. And if you want, I'll go back and show you a picture of Huxley's daughter, but you probably don't need that.
What of the Genesis story about giants walking on the earth?
Yes.
And how the sons of God and daughters of men had children?
Yes. Well, I've no idea. It's as simple as that. And if anybody does have a good idea here tonight, well, you know, maybe Desi, you can give us the answer to that question. But I'll say this. This was used by many people to be an indication of the presence of other non-human races on the face of the earth. And therefore, many people said these were, in some sense, non-Adamic or pre-Adamic creatures of one sort and another, and if you use a scientific definition that they could produce fertile offspring by interbreeding with Adam's successors, that would prove that they were, in one sense or another, truly human. So the Nephilim, the giants inhabiting the earth and so on, sometimes these were used as an argument to say this is the beginning of the sullying of the human race through intermixture with pre-Adamic or non-Adamic stock. So quite often this was regarded as evidence for non-Adamic humans. And it wasn't the only kind of evidence at all inside the text of Scripture that was used to justify the idea of pre-Adamic humans. Some of the others were simply this, the old question, where did Cain get his wife from? Answer, there already were other races. They weren't the blessed race of Adam, but there were other races that inhabited and could interbreed with the Adamic family. Whenever Cain is dismissed from the garden and then goes and builds his own city, who helps him build it? Who inhabits it? Are there already enough children of Adam and Eve by that stage to build a city? No, the argument is this is all evidence that, in fact, Adam was not the only human. He was only the beginnings of a particular type of human, and that other humans inhabited the earth. So the question about these giants inhabiting the earth is just one element of a set of questions about internal evidence that there might be other races inhabiting the earth at that stage.
So it's a bit like the other question, where did Adam's children's wives come from?
Already answered it. Yeah. Two for the price of one there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
If that question is asking me where they came from, I've absolutely no idea.
Let's go in a different direction.
Yeah.
The science of human origins, is that not a misnomer? Science works by proposing hypotheses and then testing them experimentally. It's not possible to do this with the question of origins. Would it not be better to refer to the ideas of scientists about origins rather than the science of origins?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think so for this reason. I think that it's mistaken to think of science as an enterprise that's anything other than promulgating and developing theories and accumulating good evidence in support of them, and accumulating it, in my view, to an extent where mostly it approximates truth. Now, of course, you can never say that science has arrived absolutely at the truth about any particular set of things. Why? Because science has built into it inescapably the notion of progress. And so theories come and go, hypotheses come and go, and so on. That's just how science works. So I think this is no different from any other kind of science. The geneticists do their work. The paleoanthropologists look at the fossil record. They do their work. And they come up with theories that I think are a pretty good approximation to truth. They will continue to refine them. They will continue to modify them here and there, and we'll move in progressive directions, I think. But mostly, I would imagine that that is exactly how science operates. The development of theories, the robust testing, and the moving progressively, one hopes, towards theories that get a good handle on how the world really is. Now, there are some people who think that that's far too optimistic a story. There are some people who think that science really isn't too much concerned about truth at all. And in my dark days, they're mostly Mondays, I'm inclined to think, well, there could be some truth in that. But generally speaking, I think it's an inadequate conception of science to think that either it's just toying with nonsense hypotheses that that come and go, or to think that science is just simply to give us instrumental success in dealing with the world. In other words, it enables us to land a man on the moon, but all the astronomy that getting there might be wrong. It just enabled us to do that pragmatic task. Or it might be that medicine can help us get better, but it doesn't mean that the theories underlying it are necessarily true. I think that's an inadequate conception of science. I think that science really does get a pretty good handle on a good deal of truth, though I'm sure it's not ultimately the absolute truth to be had.
Everybody wants to know this, David.
Oh, boy.
What are your own thoughts on where Neanderthal man fits into the biblical timeline? Was Adam definitely the first man?
Well, I really don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm not sure that it's important to know that answer. I certainly think that tracking our origins back to mitochondrial Eve at 200,000 years ago would be at the very beginnings of archaic Homo sapiens. But I think that as far as the biblical narrative is concerned, the biblical narrative is concerned with a theological conception of what the human is. Not whether Adam was Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, whether it was Homo sapiens sapiens, whether it was just Homo sapiens or whatever. Those are distinctions and definitions and classifications that are the product of modern science. The biblical narrative portrays humans not telling us whether it's Homo sapiens or what it is, but telling us in narrative form and in story form about a creature who could have communion with God, and a creature with whom God communicated in particularly distinct sorts of ways. And so, in that sense, I've no idea whether we would say Adam, if a single individual existed of that sort, was indeed a Neanderthal or wasn't a Neanderthal, or where the line was drawn, because that would be an arbitrary scientific line. I think that the theology of the early chapters of Genesis aren't asking that modern scientific question at all. So what I think is I really don't have a thought, if you like, about that.
Okay. What about DNA testing? Someone was asking about that.
Yes. Now, this is a very interesting question. Now, DNA testing is, now, whoever the questioner is, tell me if I've got this right. This is that you can go and get your own DNA tested, and then you find out what your own sort of ethnic lineage is. Is that what I'm? That's what you're getting at. Yes, I mean, I remember being asked this interestingly, in a talk I gave in Canada on this subject. And a woman came up to me afterwards and said that she had submitted a bit of her DNA, I think, to the National Geographic, and because I think that she might have been First Nations Canadian and wanted to find out what percentage of her lineage was. Native Canadian or Inuit. Also, I suppose when you test, you find that it's something like a couple of percent of our DNA looks as if it's derived from Neanderthal sources and so on. Now, I'm interested in this for one reason, and then there's an interesting political sort of consequence to it. So the first one is very interesting. Why would you bother? What's motivating a person to want to do this? And I think in some really important sense, it's at the heart of what I'm trying to do tonight, because the idea seems to be that your genetic lineage, your genetic genealogy, is in some crucial sense your identity. Now, it'd be interesting to really figure out if that really is important, and if that really is the case, and if so, why is it the case that a person feels that? So, I leave that for you to peruse yourself. But there's another edge to it. The Royal Irish Academy, over the past number of years, has been conducting exactly this kind of DNA mapping for all of Ireland. And so there are a range of groups that belong together genetically. They're called haplogroups. And people have sent in their DNA, got it tested, and so on. They get mapped onto one particular lineage that comes down in one of the lines from, I suppose, mitochondrial Eve somewhere. You know, it diversifies. So there's a piece that appeared in a popular magazine shortly after one of these, I think maybe the first atlas that had come out. It raised two interesting questions. One is, I wonder, the author put it, is there anything comparable here to the way in which anthropologists used to measure the size and shape of people's heads or the weight of people's brains? Or the depth of the curliness of their hair, or the hue of their skin for some kind of racial purpose. In other words, is there a link between DNA mapping and an older tradition that we've now repudiated of anthropometry, the measuring of human physical difference in order to map human races? But the second thing that was said was this. The person writing the article had interviewed some people about this, and one of them said, yes, this map shows that the Connacht men are the real Irish. Now, having seen the match against Ulster from Connacht there a week or two ago, I can tell you that maybe in America they would be called the Fighting Irish, because I tell you they really put up a great show. But it did perturb me that this might be used for purposes that are verging on that interest in race that I think I've tried to elucidate here tonight. I don't know whoever asked the question. Maybe I didn't scratch your itch at all, but that's the best I can do on that question.
Thank you very much. Well, thinking about the race question then, did migration cause races?
Right, well, that's a scientific question. Better ask a scientist, what caused racial variation? There are a few things that I think to be said about this, ironic ones, interestingly. And the first one is this. Migration, I mean, just to particularly answer the question, then to go off on my own hobby horse, which of course I generally do. Migration, of course, had a huge role to play in genetic mixing. And if indeed adaptation to environment is an important element in racial differentiation, then I'm sure migration had an important part to play in that. But I'll come back to that, because that is not the whole story, not even for a minute. Racial variation. Now, here's the first interesting thing. If you want to hold on to the idea, or if a person did want to hold on to the idea that all human beings were descended from a single original pair, not all that many years ago, called Adam and Eve, in order to hold on to that, you had to be an evolutionist. Now, let me say this. If you're a creationist about Adam and Eve, and that we're all descended from Adam and Eve, you had to be an evolutionist, because you had to believe that the human races evolved from one particular type. And the way in which they evolved was, presumably, adaptation to environmental conditions. And those environmental conditions almost always were considered to be climatic ones. That's because on the whole business of racial variation, people just looked at skin color more or less, more significantly than anything else, and believed that adaptation to climate was indeed the explanation. Well, in fact, if you go back and read Charles Darwin, he doesn't think that at all. Charles Darwin only treats the issue of the development of the races not in the origin of species at all, but in the descent of man. And in the descent of man, he dismisses adaptation to the environment as any good cause of explaining racial variation at all. He thinks the origin of this is in sexual selection, which is to do with the development of certain features that then become attractive to a mate, and those features then get selected for because those mates are attracted to one another, and sexual selection, he believes, is really where the beginnings and the development of racial differentiation occurs. The final thing I want to say about this is I want to question the question. Race is a bogus concept. It's just impossible to actually decide how many races there are on the face of the earth. Blumenbach thought there were 5. Huxley thought there were 8. Somebody else thought there were, Deniker thought there were 63. It's just impossible. Race, whilst we can see, absolutely we can see anatomical variations that are literally only skin deep mostly amongst human beings, having any fixed racial classification or taxonomy, I think, has been more a product that is humanly constructed rather than a description of real differences as far as humans are concerned. That's not to say there isn't variation. Of course there is, but the word race has with it a sort of set of connotations that are pretty tricky to deal with at the 21st century.
Thank you, David. I want to give others a chance maybe to come back on any of those answers.
Yeah, please.
Does anybody have a comment they'd like to make on any of that? Or an additional question? We've got 2 men at the back here.
He missed you, sorry.
Just a comment about what you just said about if you think the whole human race is descended from Adam and Eve, that you have to be an evolutionist.
Oh, yeah.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned, for example, skin colour.
Yeah.
It can be quite easily shown that skin colour is just dependent on one thing, and that's the amount of melanin in the skin.
Yeah.
And it can be quite easily shown that from a single pair of, mid-brown, Middle Eastern skin colour, you can get the whole range from white to black.
Good.
And that occurs with every human character. There's just so much variety within the human genetic makeup that you can get a whole range of different from Eskimos to Negroes to you know, it's all built into the human genetic makeup. So you don't have to be an evolutionist.
Can I just come back on that? What I'm saying is that in the people that I was tracking, the history of this idea, before they know very much about melanin, before they know very much about the medical material that you're talking about right now, they had working theories about the role of how climate was going to bring about change of this sort from the original Adamic person. And the consequence of that was that they had to believe in some kind of changing or developing sort of human. Now, admittedly, this wasn't necessarily to do with changing from one species to another. But if you actually believed that the races were different species, then you were committed to a notion that there must even have been an evolution of species in order to get that kind of difference from what they believed Adam to be. Since most of them believed that Adam was white, and then, of course, a few began to say, no, Adam was actually black, and then you have this notion of if there are different species, it doesn't look like just a very simple variation to them of the sort that you're talking about. So I think you're right about right now, of course, but I'm talking about the people I was trying to sort of canvas in the historical tale I was telling. So thanks for that.
Thanks. This might be more of a question for a Christian biologist, but just to press you a little on the point in relation to human descent from Adam and the concept that there was a first man. It seems to me that that is quite an important concept biblically, you know, particularly given some of the comments that you find in the New Testament around sin having entered the world through one man and so on. So, you know, I felt that that was maybe sort of skated over slightly in your response, and I just wondered whether you could touch upon that, if you had any thoughts on that, and also if you had any thoughts, obviously as a Christian who's considered this in some amount of detail, as to the distinctives between a human race that was ensouled, that was able to commune with God, contra a pre-humanic race that couldn't do those things, and what those distinctives might be, other than the presence of a soul as such.
Right. Well, I think you have three questions there. And so I'll only sort of scratch around the surface of it. I mean, I'm not a biologist. I write histories of these things. Well, I mean, I think the first thing I have to say just is that you slipped in the word ensoulment, and I didn't talk about souls at all. And there's a huge debate about whether the notion of a soul plopped in is at all the right way to think about this. Theologically speaking, great, ask a theologian about that. Now, you're asking an exegetical question about some of the New Testament passages that actually use the Genesis narrative and seem to presuppose the notion of one single human being, Adam, from whom we are all descended. Actually, just this week, there's an article that came out in the Journal of Science and Christian Faith, I think it's called, dealing with this very question and laying out much better than I could. I mean, if you send me your email, I'll send you the details about the different perspectives that a Christian theologian could take on this. And one of the things that they say is, of course, you can just take the story as that we are indeed all descended, at least spiritually, from Adam. Inasmuch as if human beings are homo divinus, like Adam was, then indeed there would be a first individual who was blessed with this homo divinus element, whatever that one might be. There's also, of course, the possibility that has been suggested by theologians for a while that indeed, if there was just a first individual who possessed this spiritual quality, others might develop it, even if they had come from a pre-hominid background. God might actually implant that into other creatures as well, so they too would bear the image of God. So even if Adam did act in a way, he would have acted in a way that was representative of all humanity. Not that we had to be necessarily genetically connected with him, because the text is actually to make an analogy with Christ. We do not have to be genetically connected to Christ in order to benefit from his act of salvation, any more than we would have to be genetically connected with Adam in order to disbenefit from the consequences of Adam's action. Another strain of thought that has been developed by some theologians is to say that the New Testament and the Old Testament interpreted and knew how to interpret early texts in Genesis in a way that did not necessarily presuppose literalism. And the thought is that even Paul might have been able, could have had that in mind when he's writing this verse. He could have made the theological point without necessarily having to have a literal interpretation in the way that you're suggesting of the Genesis narrative. Whether that's the right way to go or not is an entirely separate question, but those are some of the moves that I think I see being made amongst theologians trying to deal with that question. And I think you had another question, but in all honesty, I can't remember it, so thank you.
I have one more, David. Do those people who believe in pre-Adamic hominids believe death occurred before sin? And if so, how do they interpret the verse, the wages of sin is death?
Well, I can't answer the second bit because I never asked any of them how they interpret that verse. So I can duck out of that one. But what I can say is this, that the large number of them, I think, realize perfectly well that when you read the Genesis narrative that says, in the day that thou shalt eat thereof, thou shalt surely die. Notice I'm brought up on an authorized version generation. Did you see the thee and thou's there? Hope you're impressed with that. The day thou shalt eat thereof, thou shalt surely die. If that was literal, it was false. Because Adam certainly did not die that day. Well, then you say, well, maybe it just, you know, meant sort of in that day-ish. You already see you're getting a little metaphorical. No, most of these realized perfectly well. Their belief was this did not refer to physical death at all. It might refer to some sort of spiritual death. I mean, who knows? But certainly they believed that pre-Adamic hominids or pre-Adamic full humanity, if you wish, perfectly well passed away like anybody else. Now, whether Adam would have been different, they could reserve judgment on that. And I don't know how they would have interpreted that verse because I say I didn't ask them. But I think that mostly that notion of death, at least as physical death, was not regarded as such by many people who adopted these theories.
Does anyone else have a question they'd like to
put this evening? There was one up here, I think. Oh, yes. Stafford, thank you.
Here you go.
Could you tell me how the Big Bang Theory fits in with what you've been saying?
That question wasn't long enough for me to think of a good answer. In all honesty, I don't think it fits in really much at all. For a start, it happened a long time ago. To make a question sort of out of it, I suppose it might fit in this sense. The Big Bang Theory was developed by a Catholic cosmologist at, I think, was it Louvain? Am I mistaken about that? Whilst he said that he was not driven at all by any theological concerns, there is no doubt that the notion of an initial moment of creation from which everything is developed and everything in potential was packed into that initial explosion, I guess he and others thought was entirely compatible with a religious view of the history of the world. I think that's really all I could say about that one.
Well, David, thank you very much. I think we all go home this evening with our minds expanded in some ways. We're thinking big thoughts, I'm sure. And I trust that you'll come back again in 2 weeks' time. Not next week, but the 7th of November. But I think before we leave tonight, we want to express our appreciation once again to David for his presentation and for his energetic answers to our questions. We appreciate that very much indeed. A round of applause.